A little bit of weird music for you there. If you're watching, a little bit of weird color here in the studio because it's time for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. This is Catholic Answers Live. And people love asking Jimmy Akin weird questions because Jimmy loves the mysteries of the world. Matter of fact, he's got a podcast called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And there's a whole bunch of really good weird questions coming up. Jimmy, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Cy Kellett. Happy to do it.
What dropped today? Because it's Friday already. What dropped today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Yeah, so every quarter on Mysterious World, we ask our patrons, you know, who make the show possible, what questions they have. And they frequently have a bunch of weird ones. So it kind of fits with today's theme. And today we did a patrons questions episode in which I talked about de-extinction, like, you know, bringing woolly mammoths back.
Please.
Also becoming an apologist, artificial intelligence, deja vu, spherification of the wine for the Eucharist, left-handedness, psychohistory, and forecasting the future, who wrote the Torah, U.S. presidents and mysteries, days and indulgences, Aramaic and the Lord's Prayer, saucer-shaped aircraft, who calculated the years of the Christian era, what Jesus did after the resurrection, people who nobody prays for, Jesus walking on water, and recommendations of some great courses.
Very nice. It all sounds great, but the woolly mammoths, yes or no? Yes or no, Jimmy? And I mean, are you in favor of it or are you opposed to it?
I'm in favor of it.
Okay,
I think it would be great to have woolly mammoths back.
I mean,
we killed them off. The least we can do is bring them back.
Yes.
They actually survived a lot longer than people realize. They survived into historic times in remote locations. They weren't just prehistoric. Apparently, some of them lived on an island like off the eastern coast of Russia, off Siberia. And they were woolly mammoths, but they were a lot smaller than you would think, because they suffered from experienced a condition known as island dwarfism. Island dwarfism is a phenomenon that occurs when you have an island and species that, you know, may be big when they're roaming around on a nice big continent. When they get on an island, there's not as much food and there's not as much, the resources are more limited. And so they tend to shrink over generations so that their bodies are proportioned to the resources available on the island. And so that causes otherwise large creatures to become smaller on islands. And that happened with the woolly mammoths. So they were, you know, woolly mammoths, but they were little bitty woolly mammoths, maybe, you know, a little bit bigger than a horse or something.
It seems like that wouldn't be a big deal, except that they're called mammoths. And small mammoth,
yeah.
It just, that doesn't seem right. That seems wrong.
No, but it is one of the weird aspects of the world we live in.
Yeah. All right. So I want those woolly mammoths back, though. Somebody's got to be working on this.
Well, they are.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good. I hope we got our best people on this. This is the kind of thing you put your best people on. This first one, Jimmy, for weird questions is kind of long. So settle in and I'll read you a question from Christopher.
More airtime for you.
You know how I feel about that, Jimmy. The more airtime I can get, the better. Imagine a technology that gives two people the ability to share feelings, emotions, physical sensations, etc. with each other as if they were truly experiencing the other person in this exact state that they are in at that moment in time. I'm thinking of a situation where John is trying to explain how he feels about something important, but he just can't put it into words for Jane to understand. To solve the problem, they both connect their minds with the technology for a brief moment. Jane knows exactly the hows and whys of John's emotions, even his physical sensations of pain or pleasure. She is now able to understand him on a level that is too complex for words, resulting in greater intimacy and love between them. If we apply this to church teaching on marriage, would a husband and wife be obligated to participate in this activity as a means of total giving of oneself to the other? If not, could you think of some variation of this technology or scenario that the church would promote or even require? For the purpose of this thought experiment, assume that you wouldn't be able to abuse this technology or generally use it in a negative way.
Okay, so the type of technology that we're envisioning is a form of what's sometimes called machine telepathy. You know, telepathy is mind-to-mind contact, and this is accomplished by machines, so it would be machine telepathy. And we're not very far away from having rudimentary forms of machine technology, of machine telepathy. We can already use brain imaging to scan a person's brain in real time, and the AI algorithms are such that they can deduce certain things about what a person is thinking or visualizing. And then you can translate that onto a computer screen or transmit it over an internet connection to somebody else. So we already have, and it's been done, and so we already have a kind of rudimentary form of machine telepathy. Also, we're working on neural interfaces right now, where you would have essentially an interface, a mechanical interface, hooked up to your brain. Elon Musk has a company called Neuralink, where they have been pioneering this technology, and they want to use it, for example, for things like helping paralyzed people have greater control of their environment and so forth. And eventually, assuming the technology progresses, it'll be used for other things. And hypothetically, one day you could have a kind of machine telepathy where it lets a person not just know what you're thinking, but what you're feeling, which is essentially what's involved in Christopher's question. So we're not nowhere close to having this technology right now, but it is possible, and we are working on sort of the rudiments of this technology. Now, having said that, would Catholics, assuming that we develop such a thing, would Catholics who are married be obliged to use it? I would say, as a general matter, no. You would not need to leave yourself hooked up to this thing all the time just to understand what your spouse is thinking and feeling. The fundamental obligations of marriage fall out of human nature, which has been the same for tens of thousands of years. And so merely because you come up with a new way to do something technologically for spouses that can be helpful doesn't create a fundamental new marital obligation. There also would be privacy concerns and all kinds of things like that. But assuming that those are taken care of, it wouldn't be obligatory to use this technology, at least under most circumstances. However, it could be very useful to use a technology in particular circumstances. You know, for example, let's suppose there's a critical decision that needs to be made, and both spouses have very strong feelings, and it could be helpful for them to feel each other's perspective on those matters, even if they can't articulate it rationally. Or suppose they're having marital difficulties, and, you know, one spouse just doesn't understand why the other spouse feels or acts a certain way. Something like this could be helpful in marital counseling situations. And so I could see situations where it would be very beneficial to use such a technology in these limited circumstances. But it would not be obligatory to use it most of the time. It would be kind of like medicine or other forms of marital counseling. If something's going wrong, it can become obligatory to use medicine. Or if you're in a problematic marital situation, it can become obligatory to use marital counseling. And this would simply be another form of that. So it wouldn't be an absolute requirement, but it is something that I could see being helpful and strongly recommended in some circumstances. I also should point out, now Christopher says, suppose for purposes of the thought experiment that we wouldn't be able to abuse this technology or generally use it in a negative way. And so I did that. I made that assumption in answering the question. But in real life, there would be some significant concerns here. I mentioned one of them already, which is privacy. You would want control over exactly what gets transmitted. You know, like in any human relation, I mean, just to cite, completely setting aside confessional matters, in any human relationship, there is negotiation that goes on. And negotiation means holding back certain things that are not appropriate to bring up or not helpful to bring up at the moment. And so you would want to make sure that this technology doesn't result in you mentally blurting out something that would harm your relationship with your spouse.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're working on a problem in one area, you don't suddenly want your spouse to realize, I hate your string bean casserole, you know. And so you would want considerations like that taken care of. Also, there's another risk, which is that people's feelings aren't always, I mean, you would want a reciprocity in this, where both spouses get to share their feelings and perspectives with each other. You don't want a conversation where one spouse just gets to dominate. If John gets to communicate how he feels about something, Jane needs to be able to communicate with the technology about how she feels about the same thing. There, but then there's also the concern I mentioned of people's feelings aren't always rational. And you run a risk if John, let's suppose John has a really irrational feeling about something and he transmits that. Like, let's say he's got a phobia about a particular situation that he really doesn't want to go into because of his phobia. Well, if you transmit those feelings to Jane, Jane might become infected by the phobia.
Oh, yeah.
She might become irrational, too. And on the other hand, if Jane, it doesn't necessarily have to go that way. If Jane does not have the phobia and she's rational about this situation, her rationality might transfer to John. And so it could go both ways. It could result in a harmonious kind of meeting of minds, to use an older phrase. But you would have to worry about risks like, could irrationality be transferred from person to person and result in worse decisions rather than better ones?
Christopher, thank you for a very interesting weird question for Jimmy Akin. More weird questions coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
I'm Roy Brown, Executive Director for Billings Catholic Radio. Catholic radio is arguably the greatest tool for evangelization. Radio has the power to speak directly to individuals and creates a sense of one-on-one fellowship. There is no better way to evangelize than through a relationship where we can share and bring the love and joy of Christ to another's daily life.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Right now, December deal days over at shop.catholic.com. You can use the promo code MYDEAL22 to save an extra 20% off. Even the discounted stuff, whatever you get over there, just put in MYDEAL22. And while December deal days are going on, you get an extra 20% off. If it turns out that your purchase goes over $75, shipping costs are free within the United States. Deep discounts and free shipping. Check out December deal days now through December 7th at shop.catholic.com. All that conversation about the woolly mammoth at the beginning, Jimmy and I discussing Snuffleupagus at the break. He does seem like a woolly mammoth. He looks like a woolly mammoth to me.
He's at least similar to a woolly mammoth.
Similar to a woolly mammoth. Yeah, and you were asking me about that, and I do remember when only Big Bird could see him.
Yeah.
Before other people could see him.
He was originally a secret, and it was a running gag on the I remember when they first introduced Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street, because he wasn't originally there. They introduced him when I was a kid and I was watching.
Yeah.
And it was a running gag on the show for a long time.
Yeah.
That Big Bird would see him, Big Bird would encounter Mr. Snuffleupagus, and then Snuffleupagus, and then Big Bird would turn to someone and start talking about Mr. Snuffleupagus, and then he'd turn around and he'd be gone.
That sneaky mammoth.
Yeah.
It all changed, but I don't know when it changed because I got to a certain level at school and I stopped watching. Junior year of college, I stopped watching Sesame Street, and then years later started watching it with my kids, and Snuffleupagus was just like a regular guy. Patrick asks this. It's weird questions with Jimmy Akin. Might have been sophomore year of college. Patrick asks, is there competition in heaven? It seems to be part of human nature.
Well, competition is certainly a drive that people have in this life as part of achieving status and advantaged positions. In this life, we have limited resources. And so we need to compete to have adequate resources. And in order to motivate us to compete, we have an inbuilt competition instinct. So that's definitely part of this life. But we do have other instincts that are also part of this life, like the urge to engage in marital behavior. That's a very fundamental instinct in this life. And it's also for a reason. It gets us to reproduce so that we don't die out in the course of a generation. But we know, because Jesus tells us, that instinct will not be something that we have to deal with in the next life. We're not going to marry or be given in marriage in the next life. And so presumably we're not also not going to be frustrated by that fact, given that heaven is perfect. And so we can infer that the biological urge to reproduce is not going to be something we have to deal with. It's therefore possible that the instinct to compete could also be gone in the next life, where we'll have unlimited resources and won't need to compete for them. But it seems to me that there are some ways that there could be competition in heaven. It would not be the same as competition in this life, but it would be a sort of competition to see who can do the best job, and can we kind of like outdoing each other to serve God in a friendly, competitive way, where if someone beats us, we rejoice that the other person was able to do even better than we were able to do. It's a little bit like, they say, now I know almost nothing about sports ball. I know here in America with baseball, you want to disembowel your opponents. You want to totally crush them and win.
What kind of baseball have you been watching? I have not seen the disemboweling games.
Like I said, I know very little about sports
ball. Okay, all right.
But I am given to understand that in Japan, there's frequently an attitude where what you want to see is both teams compete equally and get a tie. And so competition could be like that in heaven. You could want to see people compete and push each other and achieve something and get a tie. Or you could even want to see, not a tie, but someone win, but everybody would rejoice in the fact that whoever won, nobody would resent it or feel bad about it.
All right. Patrick, thank you very much for that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Next one comes from Timothy. Timothy says, assuming that there is life on other planets and that they have been given the same immortal souls as we have, and assuming that they are susceptible to death as we are, does that mean that heaven, hell, and purgatory are currently comprised of human souls and the souls of what we would consider aliens too?
Well, it could mean that if you have mortal aliens who are like us in that they die, and if they have souls like ours, then presumably their souls would survive into the afterlife. And if they're fallen, they might go to hell or they might go to purgatory. And presumably some of them would go to heaven, but we don't. And so they could be there, but there are other options too. It isn't a matter of the faith. It's a matter of theological opinion about why our souls survive death. It isn't a matter of faith that they intrinsically survive death. It could be that God, and they don't have to, because God could simply stop maintaining a soul in existence at death if he chose, in which case, like anything else, if he stops maintaining it in existence, it will cease to exist. And so, hypothetically, God could not maintain their souls after death, and they might then just die and experience nothing. Or one of the options that medieval theologians talked about is that God could have created man in a state of pure nature, meaning that he would have had a natural existence that did not give him the gift of a supernatural destiny of being with God. And because God doesn't owe us heaven, and even the fact we're immortal doesn't mean he owes us to get to go be with him. And we know he has made other choices with other creatures he's made, like angels. The book of Jude says that God did not stoop to pick up angels when they fell, but he did stoop to pick up us. So that was a voluntary choice on God's part. He didn't make that choice with the angels. He might not make it with other species as well. And he might have created some of them with a purely natural destiny, where after they die, they go somewhere, but they don't get to go to heaven. It could be something else entirely. It might be pleasant, might be unpleasant, depending on whether they'd sinned. I mean, he's not going to be unjust and make someone suffer, you know, disproportionately to whatever they did in life. But it's possible they could have other destinies as well. Some he might allow to exist as ghosts forever. They might not get resurrected. Others, hypothetically, he could bring their soul back into a new body. He might have them reincarnate. He might even have them reincarnate endlessly, so they never spend any appreciable time outside of their bodies and don't go to heaven, hell, or purgatory. So we know what his will for us is, and we have a little bit of knowledge about what his will for the angels is. But when it comes to extraterrestrials, God's omnipotence could allow any number of options that don't apply to us.
Timothy, thank you for that weird question. I appreciate it. We got time for more before we have to take a break. So, Maol Sechlon, I think.
Yeah, I've always said it Maol Sechlon, but, you know, whatever floats your boat.
That floated it. Long question. Here we go. Has a convert ever been pope?
So I haven't done a review of the list of popes and done a check on, you know, what was this guy's religion when he was born. And I could probably turn up some additional convert popes if I did that. But I can say with confidence that, yeah, there have been converts who have been popes, starting with the first one, Saint Peter. He was not born a Catholic, but he became one and was named the first pope by Jesus himself. So he was a convert pope, and it wasn't just St. Peter. It would have been at least the first few additional popes after St. Peter. So like Linus, Anacletus, Clement, they probably were converts to Christianity too, because it took a while for the gospel to reach Rome, and they converted sometime during that first or second generation of Christians, but they probably were not born into Christian families. So there would have been additional convert popes immediately after Peter. And I'm sure that there have been convert popes down in subsequent centuries as well. Although, as I say, I haven't done a check to verify that and see exactly who they were.
Thanks very much for that question, Maol Sechlon, I think. This one comes from another Peter. We had Patrick before. All right, this one comes from Peter. Are the proposed alien sightings aliens or angels and or demons? This is a person who has clearly never watched or listened to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It's always demons. Or it's always aliens.
Well, it's also always aliens. So the question is it always demon aliens?
Yeah, maybe.
So the answer is, well, anything is possible. Now, lots of alien sightings are not anything unusual at all. I mean, lots of UFO sightings are not anything unusual at all. They're misinterpreted things like weather phenomena or, you know, celestial objects like stars or planets, or they're secret technologies that have been developed by various governments here on Earth. In fact, the equivalent of the SR-71 Blackbird, which was a CIA project known as the Oxcart back in the 1960s, was frequently mistaken for a UFO. But there's more to say about that, and I'll say it on the other side of the break.
It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. That's why we got the weird music, the weird lighting. Lots more weird questions to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
This is Dr. David Anders. Join us for an engaging hour of questions and answers about the Catholic faith here on Called to Communion, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
That's the weird music for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, having a little bit of fun on a Friday afternoon with Jimmy, where he actually gathers up the questions that have been asked in the various places people ask Jimmy questions and gets us a bunch of weird ones, and then we get to talk about them on the air. And Peter, you were in the midst of answering Peter's question, are the proposed alien sightings aliens or angels and or demons?
Yeah, so... So as I was saying, most UFO sightings are not actually anything unusual. They have various natural explanations, including secret technologies. Now, I was just mentioning, for example, the Oxcart, which was a CIA spy plane that was kind of the sister of the SR-71 Blackbird that the Air Force had. And one of the things about the Oxcart was, in order to make it fly high out of the range of artillery, which is one of the things you want your spy plane to do. You want it to fly very high and very fast to make it hard for your enemies to hit, so you don't stay over their territory long and you're so high up they can't shoot you down. Well, to make it light enough to fly that high and be that fast, they didn't paint it, because paint adds weight. And so it was just bare metal. It was like a silvery alloy. And it did have wings, but you could miss the wings from the right angle, and you would see this silvery disc-like thing up in the sky. Worse yet, if it was because of how high it flew, if the sun had already set from ground level, it's flying way up in the atmosphere, and the sun is still reflecting off of it.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the difference of the angle if you're high up compared to if you're at ground level. And so at twilight, you'd look up in the sky, and it's got this glowing sunset orange sunlight, you know, disc-shaped thing up in the sky. And it got regularly mistaken for a UFO. But because it was a secret project, they couldn't tell anyone that's what it was at the time. Well, some UFO sightings or alien sightings are some of them exotic, meaning they don't have one of these natural earthly causes. Well, quite possibly. And intelligent beings from another planet is a possibility for what some of them are. So would be crypto-terrestrials, meaning a hidden civilization here on Earth, or time travelers, or interdimensionals, someone from another dimension, or alien or angels, hypothetically, or demons. So any of those exotic explanations could explain some of these sightings, and I don't have a way of sorting through all that. What I can say is that the angelic or demonic explanation does not have a precedence in scripture or Christian tradition. You don't find angels or demons. Now, there will be people who are going to go to Ezekiel, but that's another matter. But you don't have people in the Bible seeing disc-like flying saucers that are identified by biblical authors as aliens or as angels or demons. Could angels or demons create such things? Well, sure. They can affect matter. They can assume physical forms. And so if they wanted to, they could create, you know, the equivalent of a nuts and bolts spaceship, or they could create the equivalent of alien bodies and walk around in them, just like they create human bodies and walk around in those. So they have the ability to do it, but we don't have a track record of them doing it in scripture or in church history. And that makes me skeptical of them wanting to do it. And so if you want to say that, even though it's possible that an angel or a demon could impersonate either a UFO or an alien, I would want to see some evidence. One of the fundamental principles I use is phenomena should be interpreted the way they appear until such time as you get evidence that they should really be interpreted in a different way. And so if you see something that looks like a nuts and bolts spaceship, you should assume it's a nuts and bolts spaceship until you get evidence otherwise. Or if you see what looks like a biological creature that is not a human or otherwise native to Earth, you should assume it's a biological creature that is not a human or otherwise native to Earth. You could get evidence that would overcome those, but you can't just say, oh, I think it could be this, therefore it probably is. That's not the way probability works. Possibility does not equal probability. In order to establish probability, you need evidence. And so I would say, if you want me to think a UFO or an alien is really an angel or a demon, fine, but be prepared to show me some evidence.
Peter, thanks for that weird question. More weird questions with Jimmy Akin. This one comes from Alyssa. My understanding is that the soul is the life principle. When stem cells are removed from a body and cultured, do they receive a new sensitive soul but not rational soul?
Okay, so the key question is, or a key question that's related to this, is what are you going to do with the stem cells? Or, you know, what kind of stem cells are they? Because there's more than one kind. Some stem cells are called by scientists totipotent. That means they have the power to become any other kind of cell in the body. It's possible that totipotent stem cells could be used to grow a new baby. And so if you use totipotent stem cells to make a new baby, to make a new zygote, well, the zygote is a human being, and so it will have a new rational soul just like we do. On the other hand, if it's not a new zygote, if it's just a cell that could become any other kind of cell that the body has, then it wouldn't presumably have a rational soul because it's not a new human being. Also, there are stem cells that do not have the potential to become any kind of cell the body has. Some of them only have the potential to become several different kinds of cells, and those are called pluripotent stem cells. And so if it's pluripotent stem cells, you can't even make a baby out of it. It's not going to ever have a rational soul. Then we get to the issue of, well, what kind of soul might it have? Because Aristotle would say the form of a living organism is its soul. That's what keeps it alive. So if you have a cluster of living stem cells and they're not a baby, what kind of soul would they have? Well, Aquinas, I'm not entirely sure what Aquinas would say, because Aquinas had the view that your entire body has one soul, one substantial form. The intellectual soul is the substantial form of your entire body. And I'm not sure what he would say about living cells that were formerly part of a body. I'm not aware of what he would say in that case. He might say that if they have the ability to maintain themselves in life, you know, you put them in a culture where they've got the nutrients they need and so forth, and they can maintain their life, so they've got a metabolism that's stable. He might say they've got a vegetative soul, which is the soul, the kind of soul that plants have that allows them to reproduce and process nutrients and maintain their metabolism. So they might have a vegetative soul on Aquinas's view, but I'm not sure that he would count them as having a soul, because they're not an organism. They're just a former part of an organism. On the other hand, Aquinas isn't the only player in town. Another very famous player is John Duns Scotus. And Scotus had a different view of how all this works. According to Scotus, every organ in your body has its own form. Now, Scotus would say there is one overarching intellectual soul that is the form of your whole body. But there also are forms for, like, your liver and your heart and your brain, and those souls give them their function. So the reason your liver is a liver and has its livery functions is because it's got the form of a liver. If your heart is alive, the reason it beats is because it's got the form of a heart, and so forth. And then the one ring to rule them all is the intellectual soul that ties everything together. But on that view, every single cell would seem, and you could call these, whether you call them souls or forms is a semantic matter at this point. So you could say your liver has the soul of a liver or the form of a liver. But every single cell is its own little bitty self-contained thing that has a life process. And so by that reasoning, on Scotus's view, every single little cell, even though he didn't know about cells, presumably every single little cell would have its own substantial form that makes it the kind of cell it is. And if you wanted to call these forms souls, which was an option back in the Middle Ages for a while. The terminology hadn't settled down at that point. Today you wouldn't, but back then you could. If you wanted to say, okay, here I've got a nociceptor, which is a pain cell. It lets us feel pain. So I've got a nociceptor. It's got a little nociceptor soul. It's so cute. And on SCOTUS's view, that would presumably be true of every cell, including the stem cells that you extract from someone.
Wow. Thanks very much for that question, Alyssa. Appreciate that. We got to take a quick break, however. We'll be right back with more Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin right after this.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What have you always wanted to know about the Vatican? Well, I'm your Vatican Insider, and I answer that question when I bring you the news about the Pope, Vatican City, and I share insights and stories from a broad spectrum of church ministries.
Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis, Saturday night, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Like the weird music, the Weird Questions music. I believe I've said that before, however. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and we got some really good weird ones here, and this one comes from Drew. Some writers through history have depicted multiple levels of hell and heaven. For example, Dante. Is there any biblical support for distinct experiences of heaven and hell?
Well, yeah. We have... what we can know with confidence is that there are different degrees of reward and punishment in the afterlife, because it's made very clear in the New Testament that, as St. Paul says, God rewards everyone according to their works. And people have different works. Some people do loads of good. Some people do a little bit of good. Some people do loads of bad. Some people do a little bit of bad. But God is going to let the punishment fit the crime, or conversely, let the reward fit the good deed. And since there's a huge spectrum of good and evil that people do, there would be a huge spectrum of rewards and punishments in the afterlife. We see an example of that in 1 Corinthians 3, where St. Paul compares the work we do in this life to building a temple. And he says you can build the temple out of ignoble, flammable materials like wood, hay, or straw, or you could build the temple out of noble materials that are non-flammable, like gold and silver and precious stones. And he says everyone's work is going to be tested by fire, and if what you built burns up, you know, if you built out of wood, hay, and straw, or to the extent you used wood, hay, and straw in your temple, those are going to be burned up and you're going to suffer loss. But he's talking about Christians here who are saved. And he says that nevertheless, the person who has this experience will be saved, but it'll be like escaping through flames. On the other hand, if you're camping out in your temple and it happens to be made out of gold, silver, and precious stones, then when the flames come to test it, it's not going to be burned at all. You'll be a cool camper and you'll get a commensurate reward, according to St. Paul. So we can be very confident that there are different degrees of reward and punishment in the afterlife. But one of the things that people tend to do whenever they see or think about a spectrum is start breaking it up into chunks. You know, like if you look at the visible light spectrum, there is a smooth transition from purple at one end of the spectrum to red at the other end of the spectrum. There aren't really lines. You know, you can put your finger down anywhere you want, and it'll just be ever so slightly different than if you moved your finger one spot to the left or right. But people don't like spectrums. like that. We recognize them, but we want to break them up into manageable human-sized chunks like red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. And so we tend to break up spectrums into these small, into these easily manageable categories. And the ancients seem to have done that when thinking about heaven and hell, but especially heaven, in Second Temple literature, which is the few centuries preceding Jesus's time and then in Jesus's time in the first century, there were a bunch of books that got written that envisioned there as being multiple heavens. And the classic number, now the number could vary, but the classic number is seven. And you see seven heavens, for example, in a first century Christian work known as the Ascension of Isaiah. In the Ascension of Isaiah, which was written about AD 67, so it's a little bit earlier than the Book of Revelation, actually. But in the Ascension of Isaiah, Isaiah is taken by an angel and he ascends through the firmament, which is the atmosphere here on earth. And then he ascends through seven different levels of heaven till he gets to the top and he sees God's throne. And then he descends back through the seven levels and the firmament and gets back to earth. And it would be easy with that kind of literature to imagine, oh, so some people are going to be good enough, they get to the seventh heaven. Others, maybe not quite as good, they get to the sixth heaven. And maybe some people, you know, those are wood, hay, and straw people, they only get to the first heaven. But to my mind, that is likely just a convenient way of masking the real spectrum of rewards. So I wouldn't expect there to literally be distinct levels like this. I think it would be more of a spectrum situation. However, the image is used, and it's even used in the Bible. If you look in 2 Corinthians 12, St. Paul's being a little modest, so he doesn't say, this is me, but he tells this story about this man, and he means himself, who was caught up to the third heaven. Now, some people have looked at that and said, oh, okay, so what could the third heaven be? Well, we have the atmospheric heaven where the birds fly, and we have the celestial heaven where the stars are. So the third heaven would be the spiritual heaven where God is. And maybe that's what St. Paul means, but we also have all this other literature about there being seven heavens. And so on that, maybe St. Paul meant I went to the third of the seven heavens or some other number.
Thank you very much. That was Drew that asked that question. Drew, thank you very, very much for that question. This one comes from Sarah. Could the other people mentioned in Genesis be the Neanderthals? See Genesis 4 and the reference to the people who might kill Cain.
Okay, so who the people who might kill Cain were is a subject that people have talked about for a long time. One of the classic solutions is that they would have been children who would have been born to Adam and Eve. Because at least if you take Genesis literally, people were living fantastically long lifespans. You could have lots of kids in centuries of time, and you could build a civilization, and someone, Cain, might encounter a distant cousin who might want to kill him, or a brother who might want to kill him. And so that's one of the classic solutions. However, another solution is that there were pre-Adamites, meaning people who existed on Earth prior to the time of Adam. And these were talked about rather a lot at different points in history, such as, for example, in the 19th century. One of my favorite operas is The Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan. And in The Mikado, there is a character named Lord Poobah, who is extremely arrogant and very proud of his lineage. And so he's got all these glorious ancestors. And at one point, he says, in fact, he is of pre-Adamite descent, and he can trace his ancestry back to a protoplasmal primordial atomic globule. So he's got this really impressive history of pre-Adamite descent. Well, would there have been pre-Adamites? Well, these days, you know, the church has looked at the question of human evolution, and it doesn't have a problem with it. You know, within certain limits, you know, like God made the souls of the first man and woman and so forth, the church doesn't have a problem with human evolution. And so if human evolution is true, there were pre-Adamites. There were people who were very similar to modern humans, but weren't modern humans, and they would have been around and able to kill Cain. So the pre-Adamite solution is one that has, you know, picked up some credibility from, you know, the emergence and acceptance by the church of evolutionary theory as a real possibility. Would they have been Neanderthals? Maybe. We really don't know, because the different subspecies of humanity, like Homo sapiens sapiens, which is what we are, Homo neanderthalensis, which is what the Neanderthals were, the Denisovans and Homo floresiensis and the other subspecies of humanity that we now know about, we don't know how they map onto biblical man. You know, Adam, you could say he's biblical man, but we don't know how far the boundaries of biblical man go. So it could be that biblical man is limited to our subspecies, Homo sapiens sapiens, or it could be that biblical man is broader than that. It might have included the Neanderthals. it might have included the Denisovans or Homo floresiensis, which were the little hobbit humans. So it's possible that Neanderthals could have been people with an axe to grind to want to kill Cain, but it's also possible that they might be considered children of Adam too.
Sarah, thank you for that. I'm going to try to get another question in for Jimmy. John wants to know this, and I want to know it too now that I've read it, Jimmy. What happens to your soul if you get assimilated by the Borg?
Essentially, your spiritual state would freeze. This is like what happens with someone who has a stroke. You know, you're going along, you're living your life, you have the capacity to make moral decisions. You're either in a state of grace or not in a state of grace. And then you have a stroke. And let's say it puts you into a coma for the rest of your life. You no longer have the ability to make moral decisions. So there's no further shifting on the part of your soul. If you were in a state of grace, you stay in a state of grace. If you were not in a state of grace, you stay not in a state of grace. Well, if the Borg assimilate you, that's essentially what they're doing. They're taking away your ability to make moral decisions. And so the state of your soul would freeze at the moment of assimilation. You'd either remain in a state of grace or remain not in a state of grace, except for the sacraments. Because if someone has a stroke and goes into a coma for the rest of their life, it's still possible to give them the anointing of the sick. And as long as they were open to receiving God's grace, they will receive it through the anointing of the sick. So if, and they'll return to a state of grace as long as they had the right dispositions. So even if you're not in a state of grace when the Borg assimilate you, if you have the right dispositions, it would be possible for a Catholic priest to come to you as a Borg, maybe as you're in the act of assimilating him, and give you the anointing of the sick, and it could return your soul to the state of grace even if you were a Borg.
Wow. John, thanks for that question. I feel bad for that priest, but it's very heroic what he did, risking.
He could also do it while you're in your regenerative state.
Oh yeah, that's true too. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops every Friday, and the new episode is patron questions, including a question about whether woolly mammoths are coming back or not. I got to hear that. I'll listen to it on the way home. I got to find out what's happening with the woolly mammoths. I try to stay up on woolly mammoth news, but I'm a little behind right now in my reading. Jimmy Akin, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
I really enjoy the weird questions. And that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.